Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Jennifer Hudson honored the memory of Whitney Houston. And Adele helped create some new memories. I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, the sound and the spectacle of the Grammy Awards. We'll open the phones. And later,
see the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth.
Before he was one-third of the teen pop act The Jonas Brothers, Nick Jonas was a child star on Broadway. He joins us to talk about his return to the stage in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Plus, we'll kick off a series called Super Collectors about people with large and unusual collections of music and memorabilia. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. An evening of triumph and tribute at the Grammys last night. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Later on the show, we'll talk to the youngest Jonas brother, Nick, about his role in the Broadway production of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And we'll kick off our week-long Super Collector series by asking why people collect the things they do. But we'll begin with last night's Grammy Award show. The evening was set to be a showcase for this artist, Adele. But another diva was in the spotlight for much of the evening, Whitney Houston, whose death on Saturday cast a shadow over the ceremony. Now, we want to hear what your favorite moment of the telecast last night was. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. But let's begin in the studio here with music writer Sophie Harris, who joined us last night on our Soundcheck Live chat. Good to see you in person again, Sophie.
Yeah, it's lovely to be back. Thank you.
And on the line with us from Madison, Wisconsin, is Duke University professor and founder of the blog New Black Man, Mark Anthony Neal. Mark Anthony, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with you, Sophie. The big surprise was... There was no big surprise. Adele walked off with all six Grammys that she was eligible for, including the three big ones.
She did, and it was about the one thing that any of us could be not nervous about. Last night's Grammys, there were so many kind of it-could-go-either-way type performances. The fact, of obviously, that Whitney Houston had died, and we didn't really know how that was going to work. We knew that there would be a tribute. But also smaller things like Glen Campbell's performance. We didn't know how the Beach Boys thing was going to work. We didn't really know how Adele's actual voice would work. So really, that was the one certainty, was that she was going to bag every award that she was up for.
And the uncertainty about her voice, boy, she put that to bed right away.
She
out
did.
On stage with a full band and orchestra, but she chooses to start a cappella.
She did. So gutsy. So inspiring. I think that all of us were agreed that the tone of her voice has changed, I think, since the last time, certainly since when she was in Soundcheck singing to you.
Mm-hmm. But I think, I'm not sure whether I would say it's changed, but certainly she seemed to be, you know, kind of measuring how much of that she was going to dole out, you know, on the stage first time back.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a smoother performance, and she didn't belt it in the way that she did, certainly when I saw her do her New York shows, which was absolutely exhilarating and kind of puts your hair on end like Sideshow Bob. But, but last night, she held back a little bit, but it was just wonderful to have her back and see her on stage, and she's so charming.
I personally liked the acceptance speech where she thanked all of the radio broadcasters who had supported her and played her
I
music.
I know. I could feel your smile radiating
across
the computers.
But the one we'll choose to play for you now is her final acceptance speech when she won Album of the Year last night.
And this record is inspired by something that is really normal when everyone's been through it. It's just a rubbish relationship. And it's gone on to do things that I can't tell you, like how I feel about it. It's been the most life-changing year. And I want to thank my record companies, Columbia Records and Excel Records. And Nick Huggett, who signed me, he's in the UK. Oh, my God, a bit of snot.
she will say anything First appearance of the word snot, we believe, on the Grammy telecast. Sophie Harris, music critic of Time Out New York, with me here in the studio. On the line, Mark Anthony Neal, professor of black popular culture at Duke University. And Mark, the whole music world shaken up on the eve of the Grammys by Whitney Houston's death. The producers had a very fine line to walk, right? Because the Grammys is supposed to be a celebration, and yet here was this major star that had suddenly gone out.
You know, there's a couple of things. One, you can imagine they don't want to exploit Whitney Houston's death. And so on the one hand, it's later in the show and it's keeping people there, but, you know, it is toned down a bit, right? It's just kind of gentle references early, of course, with, you know, LL and his prayer.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, in some ways, one of the biggest tributes to Whitney Houston was, in fact, LL hosting the show. The kind of new world of pop that Whitney Houston represented in the 1980s, you know, is embodied, you know, 28 years later by having someone like LL Cool J as a host, which was unfathomable, you know, to think about, you know, when he first started back in 1984, 1985. But I think they found the right tone for it. I mean, there'll be many, many other opportunities for folks to do a kind of full-blown tribute, you know, to Whitney Houston. In some ways, her family hasn't really had the time to catch their breath about this. So the idea that all this would be put out there in the world, you know, for display, I think was really the right choice, you know, for them. You know, what I found more problematic, you know, in a situation where, for instance, Kanye West is still kind of, you know, living down the fact that he talked over, you know, one of his competitors, you know, a few years ago
at VH,
you know, that Chris Brown performs twice, you know, given what we know about him and domestic violence. I didn't think that was a great, you know, choice by the Grammy committee at all.
So, well, I mean, they probably were not thinking in those terms when, you know. But,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But you're right. It certainly cast a different kind of spotlight on Chris Brown. What did you think of Jennifer Hudson doing I Will Always Love You, just her and a piano, a kind of very sort of classic performance of that song?
It was touching, and it spoke to J. Hud's own skills. You know, she wasn't trying to match Whitney. I mean, she was just simply trying to pay tribute to Whitney and pay tribute to what's a fantastic song. So I think, you know, their choices there, I think, were all the right pitch. I mean, I think we all would have loved to see Dolly Parton, you know, be able to, you know, to be there to tribute Whitney Houston. But again, there'll be times, you know, for those kinds of things to occur.
Well, this is what happened last night towards the end of the Grammys. Jennifer Hudson singing the song so often associated with Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You.
And
Jennifer Hudson singing I Will Always Love You as a tribute to the late Whitney Houston at the Grammys last night. A very simple performance, as Mark Anthony Neal said, you know, not trying to match notes with the great Whitney Houston recording that sold so many millions of copies. Just her and the piano, very understated, very elegant. Mark Anthony Neal is professor of black popular culture at Duke University, and black popular culture getting several kind of posthumous shout-outs last night, Mark. Etta James and Don Cornelius, the founder of Soul Train. Now, that may have been a more problematic tribute, at least to my way of thinking. What did you think of that?
You know, when they did the memorial montage, as they always do, and let me just say this, you know, some of the folks who got mentioned in that montage, I think of someone like Jimmy Castor, you know, even in passing, the Grammy committee gave them more, you know, of a passing off than, say, you know, Urban Radio has done in that regard. But I think many people were immediately surprised there was no reference to Don Cornelius. And when you finally see LL Cool Cool J and Questlove, you know, later on in his introduction to this dance segment, it almost seems as though, you know, someone at the Grammy production was watching Twitter and hearing all the chat back about the fact the lack of a Don Kennedy's tribute, and suddenly it just got thrown into there. It was just really odd to me, you know, to do it that way, if that was planned. And my sense is that it wasn't planned.
All right. Well, whatever it was, there it was last night at the Grammys. Mark Anthony Neal, nice speaking with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Sophie Harris is still with me here in the studio from Time Out in New York. She was part of our live chat last night during the Grammy telecast. Listeners, what did you think? What was your favorite moment of the Grammys last night? You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. What did you make, Sophie, of the Katy Perry apparent technical difficulties, where everything went and then black for a moment?
You just couldn't tell, could you? If it was technical difficulties or if it was her putting on a show and doing her showbiz thing. She's got a lot of rage, though, hasn't she?
Well, I mean, between the blue hair and the melting ice sculptures and the flames and stuff, it's all...
Yeah, I think...
There was a song in there somewhere.
Somewhere there was, and I think... Somewhere along the line, Gaga has a lot to answer for, because you had a couple of straight-up pop stars, the likes of Katy Perry and actually Nicki Minaj, treading a very arty route, which I don't think actually was particularly successful for either one of those artists. And it was very showy and impressive, but the songs weren't quite there.
What about Lady Gaga herself appearing dressed up as a 100-pound bag of onions?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I love the way she manages to keep a straight face, her poker face, throughout the ceremony, quietly having a little clap.
Let's take a call. Diane's on the line with us from Fairfield, Connecticut. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what was your favorite moment last night?
I absolutely loved the moment with the Civil Wars. That, to me, and that, along with Dave Grohl's little speech at the end about rock and roll, mm-hmm. kind of signify what I love about music, and counter just completely the opposite of one of my favorite artists, Paul McCartney, who I thought was awful with his original yeah. music. That it was a moment of, wow, I should watch the Grammys more often. The Civil Wars, my husband and I went and looked them up. We're completely buying their music. And that was just a great moment as a music lover to discover something new at the Grammys.
Well,
I don't think they've done before.
The Civil Wars had actually performed that song, it's called Barton Hollow, live here in our studio. And it knocked us all for a loop when they did it here. And I think there was general consensus among us, Sophie, that this was like one of the best 60 seconds of the telecast last night.
It was gorgeous.
Barton Hollow from the group, the duo, known as the Civil Wars. Lots of people today talking not about the Exorcist as done by Cirque du Soleil thing that Nicki Minaj did that we were told everyone would be talking about today, but talking about these two people, two voices, one guitar, Sophie, 60 seconds, and boy, did they make an impression.
Absolutely, and I think what's really interesting about it is that it underlines what Bon Iver's Justin Vernon had said about the reason that his band hadn't gone onto the Grammys, because the Grammys people had asked them to do a fancy pants collaboration, and he had said, well, no, that's not really what we do. And really, the Civil Wars performance just goes to show that you don't need all the fancy pants whistles and bells and supposed technical difficulties or wardrobe malfunctions or what have you, you know, to do something fantastic.
Now, Diane before, who called in, mentioned the Foo Fighters and Dave Grohl's acceptance speech, which was a very nice moment. I should just mention that that was at the fifth awarding of a Grammy to the Foo Fighters last night. So, you know, kind of surreptitiously, they had a very, very good day yesterday. Not such a good day for some of the smaller categories. We've talked about this in the past. The NARIS, the National Association of Recording Arts and Sciences, which puts on the Grammys, cut from 109 down to 78 categories. And Chris is on the line with us from the Bronx. And Chris, what did you think about the loss of some of those categories?
Well, the irony and the hypocrisy, the first tribute they do is to Etta James, and didn't they cut the blues? I mean, and then this whole thing with Whitney Houston, where would we be? Where would she have been without gospel? And didn't they cut gospel too?
There used to be a traditional blues and a contemporary blues category. Now there is simply a single blues category. And the gospel categories got knocked down from something like 4 to 2,
yeah.
Both of which went to Kirk Franklin, a veteran gospel performer. So I don't think too many gospel fans were either surprised or displeased by that, except, of course, for the other contenders. What about some of these, you know, collaborations? Justin Vernon, Bon Iver, declined.
He did.
But
bless his polite socks.
Foster the People and Maroon 5, both doing Beach Boys stuff and then being part of the Beach Boys medley.
Which I thought was terribly limp. I didn't feel like that was kind of necessary, demanded, or even especially appreciated. And I was also a little disappointed by the Coldplay Rihanna collaboration, because that's one of my favourite Rihanna songs. I think it's great. And it just sort of didn't seem to seg with what Coldplay were doing at all. And it seemed like a bit arty but slightly pointless.
It was a rather abrupt shift, too, when they went from Rihanna to... It wasn't quite the seamless mashup that they apparently hoped for. Marie's on the line, joining us from Philadelphia. Marie, what did you like in the Grammy telecast last night?
Oh, I'm kind of old school. I loved the end with Paul McCartney. It was, I thought, just a stellar way to go out.
So you liked the five electric guitars all wailing away at the end there?
It was all just great. I thought that, they wrapped up the show in an excellent signature way, sort of old school. And, I don't think anybody can do it better than Paul McCartney.
Well, he had some help from Bruce Springsteen, Dave Grohl of Foo Fighters, Joe Walsh.
Lovely
of the
Joe
Eagles.
Walsh.
Where was Bonnie Raitt? I mean, that was a real dude fest. I mean, Bonnie Raitt was in the house.
Men,
she had opened the show.
Men folk. It was a little frustrating to me, especially when you consider how they went out with the Arcade Fire last year, and that was something truly exciting, whether you're interested in that band or not. It was definitely a very safe Grammys, understandably so, but still.
My final takeaway of last year's Grammys, that final performance by the Arcade Fire, mm-hmm. where the camera cuts in on their Grammy sitting on top of one of the amps.
Yeah.
I mean, just a great wordless guy. It did not need any kind of description or explanation. There's the Grammy. It's sitting on top of the amp.
Yeah.
And the band is playing you out.
Exactly.
It was great.
And I'd actually, the thing that I really missed from this year's Grammys as well, as you know, I'm a big Kanye West fan, and I was just so surprised that album didn't make it for Album of the Year, given that it was awarded like solid 10 out of 10s across the board. It's like, oh, it's just a little rap album.
Well, he did walk off with 4 more Grammy Awards.
He did. Although, was he there? Do we know if he was present?
He was apparently not there. I mean, Otis, the song that he did with Jay-Z, one of the songs he did with Jay-Z, wins the Grammy. Neither one of them is there to pick it up. All right, so those were the Grammys.
They were.
Sophie Harris, Time Out in New York, part of our live chat online last night. That was fun, Sophie. Thanks for joining us then.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
This is Soundcheck. Coming up next, a visit from one-third of the pop group The Jonas Brothers. Nick Jonas talks about his return to Broadway and plays live in our studio. And then later, we kick off a week-long series called Super Collectors, about people with massive collections of music and memorabilia. Coming up later on Soundcheck. ¶¶ This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It might come as a surprise that before he was the object of widespread preteen affection, Nick Jonas was a working child star on Broadway. The youngest sibling in the Jonas Brothers kicked off his musical career as an 8-year-old understudy for Tiny Tim in a Broadway production of A Christmas Carol. He later went on to play roles in Annie Get Your Gun, Beauty and the Beast, and Les Miserables. Last month, the now 19-year-old singer began a 6-month return to the stage in the leading role in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Nick Jonas joins me here in the studio. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
So how did you start on Broadway as an 8-year-old?
It's a funny story. I was actually quite passionate about singing and performing at a very early age, from the time I can remember, really. And I was in a hair salon with my mom when I was about 6 years old, and I was just singing, as I always did. And she was getting her hair done. Someone came up to me and my mom and said, you should go see this manager that my son is working with, and, he's doing a Broadway show right now. And so I went and saw the manager with my parents, and basically the manager sent me out on some auditions, and soon enough I was on the Broadway stage performing in A Christmas Carol with Frank Langella at the time, and then Annie Get Your Gun and Beauty and the Beast and Les Mis followed that, and then a kind of a career in recording and touring and all that came a bit later, but it was a fun way to start my journey in music.
Was that here in New York, the hair salon and meeting the manager?
It was. I grew up in New Jersey, so just across the river.
Right.
So it would have been Wyckoff, New Jersey.
So you're the youngest of the three Jonas Brothers. Were you the first one to actually get into professional singing?
I was. It did start with me, and I did these Broadway shows. My brother Joe actually did a Broadway show as well. He did La Boheme, Baz Luhrmann's production.
Oh yeah,
which was amazing. And so we both had some theater experience prior to our work together in the Jonas Brothers. But I think learning that work ethic at a very young age was really influential for me and kind of shaped who I am as a person and as a performer as well.
So now you get a chance to come back after a number of years away, and does it feel like a homecoming? Do you kind of feel like you have to sort of get back up to game speed, so to speak?
It's been great returning. I had the opportunity to go and do Les Mis over in London in the West End there back in 2010, playing Marius. I played Gavroche when I was a kid here in New York, and it was a dream role of mine to go back and to play Marius one day. And Cameron McIntosh had me a part of the 25th anniversary performance at the O2 Arena, which was a dream come true and a real life-changing experience. And from that moment on, I kind of knew that getting back into theater and making that a priority was important for me. And so I basically, once my brothers and I finished up our touring and kind of went on a bit of a hiatus, we still are, obviously, yeah, but I pursued some different opportunities, Hairspray out in L.A. at the Hollywood Bowl, which then brought about this, and now I'm here in New York leading men in How to Succeed, and it's such an incredible show, such an incredible cast and creative team, and one of those roles that you really can take ownership of, and it's been a fun experience.
Now the role is for folks who aren't familiar with the story, you're this young upstart named J. Pierpont Finch.
Pierpont,
right? Pierpont.
Yes. Pierpont. Pierpont. I like that too. That's good.
So anyway, Finch is like this young up-and-comer, and in the history of this role, you are stepping into some pretty big footsteps. Most recently, of course, Daniel Radcliffe, but Robert Morse and Matthew Broderick both won Tonys for it. So, how do you succeed in How to Succeed in Business?
It's one of those roles that so many amazing actors have played, and starting with Bobby Morse, one of my favorites ever, and particularly in this role, it's been kind of an honor to think about who's played the role and coming in and doing it, and Matthew Broderick, a legend, and Daniel was fantastic in this show and this production, starting it up, and really, I think what's been great is bringing a new audience into the Broadway community, starting with Dan and all that he did. And kind of the ownership that he took of it was inspiring. And for me to have the opportunity to do the same thing, to bring a new audience to the Broadway community, people that may be familiar with the show, to have them come see it again. And it's been a really diverse audience every night that we've had. And it's so great to see so many different people and different age groups and walks of life enjoying this production.
You would have to think a lot of them are seeing their first ever Broadway show, especially the younger people.
Yeah, I think the younger side of the audience that is there, it might be their first Broadway experience. And what's been great about this last week is, we had Kids Night on Broadway, which is a great thing that they do, where a kid on between the ages of 6 and 18 get in for free with an adult.
Yeah.
And so that was a great thing to have, some young people in the audience. And it was fun for me to kind of be the spokesperson for that as well.
We're speaking with Nick Jonas. He is the lead in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying at the Al Hirschfeld Theater until July 1st of this year. He's here in our studio. I Believe in You is kind of one of Finch's signature songs. You want to do that for us?
I would love to sing I Believe in You.
All right.
Great.
Matt Perry is waiting over at the piano, so let's hear Nick Jonas in a live performance here on Soundcheck. I Believe in You, from the musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Now there you are. Yes, there's that face. That face that somehow I trust. It may embarrass you to hear me say it, but say it I must. Say it I must. The cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet there's that upturned chin and the grin of impetuous youth. Oh, I believe in you. I believe. And when my faith in my fellow man all but falls apart, I but to feel your hand grasping mine, and I take heart. I take heart to see the clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet with the slam, bang, tang, reminiscent of gin and vermouth. Oh, I believe in you. I believe.
Nick Jonas, singing live in the Soundcheck studio, I Believe in You, is part of his role as J. Pierpont Finch in the musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Nick is in that role through July 1st this year. How different, if at all, is it to sing a Broadway song like that from the Broadway stage as opposed to singing, harmonies with your brothers in a studio or out in an arena somewhere?
It's very different, and I think in a lot of ways in this past year and a half, my voice has changed quite a bit, just having done Les Mis and sort of relearning that training, that vocal training that comes from needing to support that and also the vocal stamina that's required to do 8 shows a week. You have to place things in a different place than when you're touring. You have a bit more flexibility. I'd say especially when you have two other guys who sing quite a bit as well. But I love this singing style, and I feel like this show specifically – Frank Lesser's score is one that I love singing and enjoy the placement of it in my voice, and it's been fun to really dig in and work with this team on the show as to how we can make this role and this vocal role exciting for me as well in a lot of ways. So maybe changing up a few things and giving it some extra oomph.
Now, when did you start actually singing with your brothers? Doing the 3-part harmony and all of that.
My brothers and I started back in 2004. We wrote a song called Please Be Mine, and I was actually signed to Columbia Records first as a solo artist after recording a Christmas song that someone heard over at Columbia and wanted to sign me. And so I started working on a solo record and wrote a song.
How old were you then?
I was 12. wrote a song with them, my brothers, that is, for that record. And they heard it over at the label and wanted to sign all three of us. And so we started working on the record and made an album called It's About Time, released it on Columbia Records, and it did not do very well. But it was probably the best thing that happened for us because, you know, we were dropped by Columbia Records and had to make a decision to either press on or sort of call it quits at that point. And luckily we pressed on because we found a home at Hollywood Records in L.A. and had a bit more success after that.
Yeah, I would say so. But you also said before that your early work on Broadway as a child actor sort of gave you a work ethic that has stood you in good stead. Goodness knows, we've seen a lot of, you know, young kids who hit it big and are ill-prepared for what comes after. I mean, you could even say Whitney Houston might have been a little too young for all the success, and she was in her 20s. So, I mean, have you found that, you know, that you have this kind of grounding in the theater? Has it helped you as you've gone to make this transition from teenage heartthrob to an adult with a career and...
Well, yes, just to start in mentioning Whitney Houston, let me just say I'm so devastated to hear this about her and found out just before we went on stage the other night. And it was a tough blow to all of us, I think, in the cast. You know, she's so inspiring to so many people, specifically people, you know, who I think have a passion for music. And as one of the greatest voices of all time, I think it was a real tragedy to see her go. So prayers and blessings to her and her family. As far as the work ethic goes, I think that, you know, being around people who work so hard to master their craft always inspires you to be the best you can be. And the thing about Broadway people specifically is that as well as being a passion for them, being able to perform and something they love doing, they must because it does require so much of your life. They are also some of the hardest working people in show business. And anyone that isn't from the Broadway community and comes in and does a Broadway show, I think will tell you that it is probably one of the harder things they've ever done. And the schedule is intense, and the stamina and all that it requires of you emotionally as well can be really challenging. And that's why these people in this Broadway community are so inspiring to me. And I think... you know, played a big part into who I've become as a man, and I'm honored truly to be around them all.
Nick Jonas is my guest on Soundcheck, starring in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Also later this month, on the 27th, you're in an episode of Smash.
I am.
The TV series about these self-same people, you know, all of them very hardworking and some of them a little conniving. And I mean, how have you watched the first couple of episodes?
I have. I saw the pilot just before I was on the show, before I filmed my episode. Loved the show. I thought it was really smart and very real to the way that this whole theater community works, which as someone that has had experience in it is great for me to see because it means that I can connect with it on a sort of more personal level. And I think all the people that are fans of theater can connect with it in that way. But the brilliant thing about this show is that it sort of breaks down all barriers and everyone can find something about this show that they love. And obviously the numbers for the first episode were huge, and so congrats to everyone there. And again, thanks for having me. But my character is Lyle West. He's a young performer and sort of, you know, TV star that has come into some financial success. And basically Angelica Houston's character tries to get me to invest in Maryland, the workshop. And it's a really fun episode. And my character is, you know, precocious but very intelligent, very witty. And you know, he and Angelica Houston have quite a bit of interaction, which was so much fun for me.
All right. So that's coming up on February 27th on the it's 2 weeks from the next installment of the TV series Smash.
Which is tonight, I think.
Right, the next one is tonight. And, of course, it got those huge ratings in the wake of the Super Bowl, so they
yes.
placed it well for its initial, for its debut. Have you had to deal with, I don't know, any skepticism from, you know, colleagues on Broadway? Oh, well, here's this, you know, he's one of the Jonas Brothers. What's he doing stepping into a major role on a... you know, a Frank Lesser vehicle like this?
I think, I think there was a general understanding from the Broadway community because I had worked with so many of them in the past. You know, the thing about it is it's so tight. The group is so tight and it's such a small world that you really see a lot of the same faces. And so obviously I was a bit younger then. I you know, would have been now 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a general understanding that's where I come from, something that I'm a fan of myself. And hopefully, you know, my performance and My hard work being put into the show pays off and people enjoy the performance. But the response has been tremendous so far, and not only from the theater community but from people that maybe aren't as familiar with the theater world who have come and enjoyed this. And it's a brilliant company. The whole cast is great. We have Beau Bridges and Michael Urie in it right now, and Tammy Blanchard is amazing, Rose Hemingway. So some really talented people who just do an absolutely incredible job every night. And so hopefully I can continue to do my best.
Well, now, the Jonas Brothers are on hiatus, obviously, while you're doing this. But while they've been on hiatus, this is not the only kind of side project you've been pursuing. Tell me about Nick Jonas and the Administration. Is this you as a songwriter?
This is a really fun project I was able to do. My brothers and I write our music, and we have now for 7-8 years. But there was some music that was on my heart that I just wanted to write and experiment with that was a bit different than the Jonas Brothers sound. And so actually now back in, it would have been 2009, I recorded this record with basically some guys that were part of the New Power Generation, and one of John Mayer's guitar players and our producer John Fields went and made kind of a blue-eyed soul record in Nashville and recorded it like you would have recorded a record back in the 60s, you know, just all of us in ISO booths jamming out and playing these 11 songs. And it was a fun project to make. I toured that and then just back in October this last year went down to South America and toured it there, which was incredible. The fans down there are amazing and really received this record with open arms. It was number one in a lot of the country that we went to, which was great. And so it was fun for me to do that. And, you know, it's always one of those things that I can kind of come back and do, as well as the Jonas Brothers and the theater work that I do as well.
This is from Nick Jonas and the Administration, the title track from Who I Am. That's the title track from Who I Am, Nick Jonas and the Administration. Nick Jonas from the Jonas Brothers, now starring in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And Nick, we wanted to wrap up the segment with this this sort of newish Jonas Brothers tune called Dance Until Tomorrow. And while we were listening to that, you just told me that it's actually kind of a leaked track, right?
It's a really funny story. This is a song that we wrote in the process of writing our last record, which was, you know, written back in late 2008 and 2009 and released in 2009. So it's been a while. But we were writing this, and it was one that sort of we liked, but we didn't put on the record. And we kind of just left it on the side. And some other artist expressed interest in recording it. And probably about 2 months ago, I was sitting at home and I was looking at my Twitter feed, and all of a sudden I see all these comments, love the new track, love the new track. I'm so glad the Jonas Brothers are back. And I was thinking, I didn't know the Jonas Brothers were back. What are they talking about? And so I went on and did some more research. And, yeah, it's a song that just got leaked somehow. And we've never had a leaked song before, so it was kind of shocking to us. But the fan reaction was really positive. I will say I don't know, you know, what the next Jonas Brothers record will sound like, because we haven't started writing yet. And so by no means is this like, you know, what it will sound like.
Right.
But and quite frankly, it probably will sound different. But,
yeah.
You know, it's funny how that happens, especially this day and age when you have to deal with sort of just songs leaking and not knowing where they're leaking from.
Well, we're going to assume that whatever happens with the next Jonas Brothers record will be after July 1st, because up until then, you're busy.
Yes.
Booked playing the role of J. Pierpont Finch in the musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. It's at the Al Hirschfeld Theater until July 1st. Nick Jonas, thanks so much for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Jonas Brothers, the leaked track called Dance Until Tomorrow. And all this week, Soundcheck is profiling people who obsessively collect music and music memorabilia. We'll kick off our Super Collectors series by talking about why people collect things. That's coming up next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. On a very busy edition of the show today, we kick off a series called Super Collectors. All this week, we profile people with large and unusual collections of music-related stuff, from CDs and vinyl to autographs and memorabilia. There's still time to tell us about the super collector in your life. Our nomination form is on the web at wnyc.org/soundcheck, and your super collector might end up on the air. But let's kick things off in this series by asking a simple question. Why do we collect things? Joining me on the line is Susan Slowicki. She is managing editor of Goldmine Magazine, which bills itself as the world's largest marketplace for collectible records, CDs, and music memorabilia. Susan, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So what is behind this impulse to collect?
You know, people do collect for a variety of reasons. Some people, it's just stress reduction. Some people, when it comes to anything having to do with music and music memorabilia, it tends to fall into some pretty specific categories. You have audiophiles who want to collect and buy their music for the best possible sound experience. Money's no object. They have super high-end systems, and it's all about enjoying the music.
Mm-hmm.
You have some fans who collect just because they love the band, the music. It was what they were growing up with. And it's like, you know what? Oh, my gosh. I might not like that album, but it's the Beatles, so I have to have everything. I love the Beatles. And they may really, you know, prefer that one particular group. Or some even like to collect just based on I like to collect CDs or I like to collect 45s or I like to collect something on a certain label. Then you have nostalgics. Those are the people who collect from an era that brings back really great memories. It's kind of like a personal soundtrack or scrapbook from their life. They're kind of collecting their memories and forming their own soundtrack. Maybe it's doo-wop, maybe it's Elvis, maybe it's British Invasion. For people in my era, it might very well be hair metal. So it's all kind of what reflects about you and the things that you pop the CD in or put the album on, and it takes you back, and it makes you feel good.
Now,
and then there are investors, too. And
right.
People who collect with an eye toward, okay, this is an investment, just like a 401k or anything else, and they invest with the idea of, I'm going to build something of value and have it.
Well, but I would guess, just from looking over many of the nominations in our Super Collectors series, that most of these people are not investors. There is something, there's a kind of a love, a compulsion, maybe even an obsession behind some of the collections that we've got pictures of on our webpage. We're using the term super collector for these folks. What does that signify to you?
Super collector to me is the guy you meet who's got a two-bedroom apartment and 30,000 record albums crammed into it. And I know a guy like that.
Yeah. I think we all do.
And
may I just say something, Susan?
Sure.
They're always guys. Why is that? I don't know any women who have a two-bedroom apartment and 30,000 LPs.
Well, here's the deal. I think there's a couple things. My anecdotal experience based on the men in my life, my brother who has an entire barn full of stuff that he collects and likes to have, my brother-in-law who collects model railroad trains, my husband who collects tools. Guys like stuff, and women don't like dusting it. So that's my guesstimate is part of the reason is it record collections are big, they're bulky, they're heavy to move, they require a lot of care. And for me personally, I love the music. I love to listen to the music, but for me to worry about whether something is a rare pressing or a super rare record, I'd be afraid to play it. Mm. I just want to enjoy the music, and I want something that I can have in a compact storage and my house will still look neat, and I don't have to dust it or buy an outbuilding for it.
We're speaking with Susan Slowicki, who is managing editor of Goldmine Magazine, and perhaps talking herself out of a job as we speak. The world's
I have a lot of CDs, don't get me wrong.
Okay.
The record albums are not what you would consider something light or easy to move.
Oh, believe me, I know. What is the most impressive or unusual music collection that you've seen?
I haven't seen it in person. I've only seen it in video, and that was of Mr. Paul Mawinney. People may not know of him. A few years ago, his collection gained additional notice. He was trying to sell the entirety on eBay, and he had 1.5 million records and I think another million or a million and a half close to that of singles in vinyl. And he was a true archivist. He had a copy of just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was his name again? Paul?
Paul Mawinney. He was in Pennsylvania. And
yeah, yeah.
You would look at this, and it was a warehouse, but it was organized like a library, and just the custom shelving and everything. And he knew what he had. He enjoyed what he had. He enjoyed collecting. And like a lot of collectors, got started when he was a kid. I mean, some guys collect baseball cards. Some people collect records. You talk to a record collector and you ask them, what's the first record you ever got, or what's the first record you ever bought with your own money? Almost all of them can tell you, and they have a special memory attached to that, whether it's, you know, my aunt bought me my first record, or I bought this myself, or I started out collecting Kiss bubblegum cards and then bought their music. So there's, you know, that sense of accumulation over time. But, yeah, when you're talking 3 million records, that's a pretty serious collection.
That's a super collection, for sure.
Yes, sir.
What about, it seems, again, just from the various things that people have sent to us on our webpage, that the Beatles tends to be, you know, a gateway drug for lots of super collectors.
And you know what? With good reason. The Beatles, not only in addition to having their music being very recognized, you go across the culture, across the generations. My mom, who's in her 80s, knows who the Beatles are, can tell you what Yesterday sounds like. You know, my nephews, who are in their teens, know who the Beatles are, and they can tell you about their songs, too. So there's a universal appeal with the artists to start with, and then it kind of grows from there. The Beatles have a lot of interesting things to collect. One of their albums is collected more for the cover of the album than what's actually in it. And
which album is that?
It's called Yesterday and Today, and it was kind of a compilation. It was only issued here in the U.S. and in Canada, and it has different states of covers. Initially, they put out what was called a butcher cover, mm-hmm. which has a very unattractive grouping of doll parts and meat parts.
Yep.
Draped over the Beatles. And there was the first state where it was issued, and that was how it was printed. Those are somewhat rare. There was the second state where they plastered a different image over the top of that, and the different image was the guy sitting with a traveler trunk. And then the last third, you know, stage where somebody has peeled away that sticker to reveal what was beneath originally. That's one that, you know, you're collecting it for the art even as much as, you know, the records or anything.
Right.
There are rarities out on early labels. Before the Beatles hit it big, they had, you know, records out on BJ, and there were records on Swan. And so people are looking for those older, more unusual, bigger rarities. And even things like test pressings are also very attractive to a collector who really wants to have something that feels like a part of history,
right.
and then, something that's rare.
And then there are also the deluxe editions that they keep putting out. I mean, last night, Paul McCartney won a Grammy for Best Historical Album for this deluxe edition of the Wings album called Band on the Run. And this song is from one of the bonus tracks from that set.
Country dreamer. I'd like to walk in a field. Country dreamer.
remember the words. I'd like to walk in a field with you. Take my hat and my boots off too. I'd like to lie in a field with you. Would you like to do it tonight? Would you like to do it?
Country Dreamer is one of the bonus tracks from the Paul McCartney and Wings deluxe edition of the album Band on the Run. And he won a Grammy for Best Historical Album last night for that. We're speaking with Susan Slewicki. She is managing editor of Goldmine Magazine, which bills itself as the world's largest marketplace for collectible records, CDs, and music memorabilia. There's a link on our webpage. And just quickly, Susan, Jack White has, for I guess similar reasons, become a favorite of some collectors, right?
His own label. He formed his own label, Third Man Records, and they have done so many fun things, whether it's one-of-a-kind album art and pressings of singles to, they put out some glow-in-the-dark records a few years ago, which were super cool for Halloween.
And very, so they're very limited, so they are by definition then collectible. One of them is this, is Jack White's band Dead Weather doing a cover of Gary Numan and the Tubeway Army's Our Friends Electric from 1979. We'll let that play us out. And Susan Slewicki of Goldmine Magazine, thanks for helping us kick off our Super Collectors series today.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Our Super Collectors series continues tomorrow. We'll open the phones to find out what you collect and why. And local big band maestro Vince Giordano talks about his unusual storage solution for his massive sheet music collection. Plus, for Valentine's Day, a playlist of creepy love songs. Tomorrow on Soundcheck.